Good morning and welcome to The Bridge, Coast Community Radio's own weekly news magazine. I'm Kate Brister. This morning we'll think about health, energy, and the environment. Leah Moriarty reports on efforts to make the marijuana growing industry less reliant on the region's electric power. Currently, the industry makes up 1% of the nation's use of electricity. By 2035, electrical use in the Northwest region alone could reach 3%. Last week on The Bridge, we reported on the decision of the Warrenton-Hammond School District to retire Native American mascots and names. This morning, Tom Bonsey examines the question of questionable names region-wide. For some people, the old names are offensive and don't represent the public sentiment anymore. For others, the place names are an important and colorful part of history. This is The Bridge for the week of May 26th. We begin with a look at one of the most widely used painkillers in the United States. We're speaking of Tylenol. One of its main ingredients, acetaminophen, is present in over 600 over-the-counter and prescription medications. Several recent studies are highlighting concerns about this very familiar drug. Correspondent Jennifer Margulis has the report.
Stacy McDonald is bouncing her fussy baby while trying to find something to occupy her 5-year-old. She tells me she gets headaches twice a week and migraines almost every month.
I have visual disturbances, kind of like tunnel vision. I also get numbness in my hands and my face. And then pretty soon after that, like within an hour at least, is like nausea and then the really intense pain.
McDonald is a stay-at-home mom of two. She lives in Phoenix, Oregon. She says the pain is excruciating.
It's like if somebody put your head in vice grips and tightened it really, really, really tight. So it was really contracted and then let it go all at once. So it's like this pulsating, this really intense pulsating pain.
Like millions of other Americans, McDonald finds some relief from Tylenol. But though Tylenol is a go-to drug, evidence is accumulating that it may not be as safe as people think.
Acetaminophen has effects that we don't normally associate with it.
That's Daniel Randles, a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Toronto.
Some labs have found that it reduces feelings of social rejection or social frustration. We found that it reduces reactions to uncertainty. Some people have even found that it makes it harder to feel really strongly about things.
Randles is a lead author on a new study published in the peer-reviewed journal Social, Cognitive, and Affective Neuroscience. His team gave some participants acetaminophen and others a placebo. The participants were then given a task to hit a button every time they saw the letter F, but not when they saw the letter E, and their brain waves were recorded. Participants who had taken the acetaminophen not only made more mistakes, their brains were less able to perceive that mistakes had been made.
We have reasonably good evidence from the study to suggest that acetaminophen is inhibiting some ability to actually perceive or detect errors.
On its own, this small study might not be that remarkable, but it's part of a growing body of scientific evidence suggesting acetaminophen has negative effects on the brain. When Norwegian researchers examined the health outcomes of 48,000 children, they found that children of women who had taken acetaminophen during pregnancy were 70% more likely to have developmental delays and brain abnormalities than children whose mothers didn't take the drug. In a Danish study, researchers tracked over 64,000 children. Children whose mothers used acetaminophen during pregnancy were at higher risk for attention disorders. The more often moms used the drug, the more severe the problems in their children. In a just-released study, researchers at the University of Texas Medical School also found that the pediatric use of Tylenol is associated with childhood autism.
McNeil Consumer Healthcare, makers of Tylenol, disputes these findings. In a written statement, they say these studies do not show a, quote, causal link between acetaminophen use during pregnancy or in childhood and adverse effects on child development, including autism. Federal authorities are also not convinced. In January, the Food and Drug Administration said that the medical evidence is, quote, too limited to make any recommendations based on these studies at this time, but that pregnant women should, quote, consult with their healthcare professional before taking any prescription or over-the-counter medication. That's what Stacy McDonald did when she got pregnant for the first time. She used to take Tylenol for every headache, but her midwives told her to avoid it. These days, when she feels a migraine coming on, McDonald tries other remedies first.
Turn lights off, try to get away from the sunlight, because a lot of times, like, light and loud noises and stuff can make it worse. And if that doesn't work, I will try, you know, caffeine, a cup of coffee or some black tea. If that doesn't work, I turn the TV on for the kids to be distracted and try to lay down.
Stephen Wells thinks McDonald has the right idea. Wells is a family physician in Phoenix and has been practicing medicine for 25 years. He notes that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is now encouraging doctors to recommend non-pharmaceutical treatments for ongoing pain.
There is really good evidence that non-medication treatments are at least as effective as medications. Ice, massage, stretching, aerobic exercise, mindfulness, yoga, all those wonderful things.
We tend to think of Tylenol as safe because it's so widely used. But that assumption may be wrong.
I do not believe that it is safe to assume that because something is used a lot, it is safe. There are many other effective treatments besides medications, and it makes sense to do the least toxic thing, the healthiest lifestyle thing you can.
The jury's still out on Tylenol. Until we know more, Wells says, it's best to proceed with caution. I'm Jennifer Margulis, reporting.
May is Mental Health Awareness Month. Experts say we should think twice the next time we call someone crazy or mentally ill. 1 in 5 adults experiences some form of mental illness in a given year, according to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI. Chris Bonneff, head of the Oregon chapter of NAMI, says how we talk about it can negatively impact people who suffer from mental illness.
The language does contribute to the perception that these are permanent things, these are things that cause disability, these are things that if you encounter them in your life, if your family is affected by it, if you're affected by it as an individual, that there's no hope.
Bonneff says mental disorders are health conditions and should be treated as such. The National Alliance on Mental Illness, in accordance with other health officials, say people should take a nuanced approach to talking about disorders by using people-first language. Bonneff says the lack of such language is unique to discussions on mental health, where sufferers are frequently referred to as the mentally ill instead of people with mental illnesses.
This is healthcare, and you don't walk around calling people the cancers or walk around calling people the heart diseased.
People are often labeled by disorders that are highly treatable and often temporary. Stigmas attached to such labeling often keep people from seeking help. Bonneff says mental illness should be normalized so that people aren't afraid to seek treatment.
We know that if we get help to people quickly, we're very, very effective at preventing a mental health condition from getting worse.
To find mental health support in Oregon, go to namior.org. In our look at health this morning on the Bridge, we have two stories from Washington State. Steve Jackson tells us it looks like it will cost more to purchase health coverage in Washington next year through the state's health insurance exchange.
Health insurance companies that sell individual policies in Washington State want to increase their rates by an average of 13.5% in 2017. Insurance Commissioner Mike Kreidler says the increases are larger than last year's requested rates.
They're significantly higher than what we saw last year. We were down around 5 or 6% rate increase on weighted average, and it was even lower than that in the first year. So for this is the third year in a row now, so insurers are starting to get real information, better information than they had before from experience. And as a result of that, you're seeing some fluctuation now in the rates as they, in this case, go up, and maybe they should have been a little bit higher in past years.
He notes, however, that people who can't afford the higher rates will also benefit from an increase in government subsidies.
In the case where they receive a subsidy, it would hold them a little bit more harmless, so to speak, going with the increases in subsidies.
The subsidies are based on the average price of what are called the silver insurance plans offered through the state's health benefit exchange. Last year saw more price increases in the bronze range of plans, while at the same time, the subsidies for those plans went down. Kreidler says some consumers are discovering it may be better to pay for a silver plan.
They understand that there are some downsides. Just paying a low premium, it might not, on a monthly basis, might not be the best approach for them personally. They should be looking at a lower cost sharing on their part, but paying more for their premium. And so we're seeing fewer people who gravitate to those bronze plans as we saw it in the past.
At the same time, there are many lower-income people who can only afford to pay for those bronze plans. I'm Steve Jackson reporting.
Alzheimer's disease is the third leading age-adjusted cause of death in the state of Washington and kills there at the highest rate in the nation, according to a Pew Charitable Trust analysis released this week. State officials are not taking this alarming data laying down. The Dementia Action Collaborative, created by lawmakers in 2014, met for the first time in April. Bob Leroy, head of the Alzheimer's Association and a member of the collaborative, says the group hopes to use available resources to address the disease.
We think we can do a lot by more effectively leveraging existing programs and resources, and that's really where we're going to focus our efforts for the balance of the current year.
The collaborative is a diverse group made up of state agency officials, members of the governor's office, home care providers, and even people who have the disease. It will meet again in September. Leroy says the group could bring recommendations to legislatures during the 2017 session if members find their short-term policies have been effective. One of the issues the collaborative is looking at is cost. Leroy says ballooning prices should motivate the public to focus on the disease.
Even if you're fortunate enough not to be touched by the disease in your family, you're going to have to help pay for the cost of care of those that are.
He adds, if current trends continue, the cost of the federal health care system is enough to bankrupt it. However, Alzheimer's is a relatively newly researched disease. While there doesn't appear to be a prevention method on the immediate horizon, Leroy says researchers have learned heart health is connected to the disease and active lifestyles can help preserve quality of life. You're listening to The Bridge. The Owyhee Canyon lands are the connective tissue surrounding lands in the West, according to a new study. That's not an exaggeration. Researchers with the Conservation Science Partners compared the southeastern area of Oregon with Bureau of Land Management and other lands across the West and found the Owyhee to be one of the most biologically diverse and ecologically intact in the region. Brett Dixon, chief scientist of the report, says his team studied the area at a landscape level and found a high degree of what he calls naturalness.
This notion of landscape naturalness is basically the inverse, if you will, of the level of human impact.
The report concludes there's a particularly high conservation value to the 2.5 million acres of Owyhee Canyon lands because of its overall importance to the area. The canyonlands have so far maintained this preservation without permanent protections, although Dixon says local proposals for resource extractions could threaten it. The Owyhee also has one of the darkest night skies in the West because of its remoteness. Christine Albano, who also worked on the study, says the lack of development in the area is quite astonishing given its size.
It's one of the most intact landscapes that are 2.5 million acres in size, and that's even comparing it to areas like Yellowstone National Park and the Grand Canyon.
Dixon says combining his group's study with other local research, the Owyhee's uniqueness becomes apparent.
The Owyhees have, I think, close to 24 endemic plants, so found nowhere else on the planet. And so when you couple those local scale values with the landscape ecological importance that we identified, I think it makes a really strong case for protection.
Oregon Farm Bureau President Barry Bushu testified before the House Rural Communities Committee at the state capitol on May 23rd. Bushu testified against a potential designation by President Obama to make the Owyhee Canyonlands a national monument. The designation would affect the entire 2.5 million acre area in the Owyhee Canyon lands along the Oregon-Idaho-Nevada borders, an area larger than the states of Delaware and Rhode Island combined. It would cover about 40% of Malheur County's total land base. Bushu beseeched the lawmakers to listen to the people who actually live and work near the canyon lands, the families whose lives would be directly impacted by a monument designation. At a ballot in March, an incredible 90% of voters in Malheur County opposed a national monument, as a designation by the president without a vote by Congress would completely disregard the rural voices, according to Bushu. An executive action for a monument also does not require that its economic impact be determined. Bushu said a monument would decimate Malheur County's historic cattle industry, an essential economic driver and job creator for the region. It would limit grazing, open ranchers up to litigation, and likely put out of business families who've worked the land for generations. Astoria will hold an emergency preparedness forum this evening at the Liberty Theater. The event will cover a range of topics, including the Cascade Subduction Zone, earthquake, and tsunami. Eric Bengel of the Daily Astorian has the details.
Immediately after a Cascadia Subduction Zone earthquake, emergency responders, including Astoria's, will likely be as paralyzed as everyone else, according to City Councilor Drew Herzig. Residents and visitors unlucky enough to be on the North Coast when the big one hits should plan to take care of themselves, he said. Focusing on emergency preparedness is one of the City Council's goals for the year, and on May 31st, a panel of experts will speak at the Liberty Theater on Astoria and Clatsop County's state of disaster readiness. The forum will cover a range of natural disasters facing the North Coast, from winter storms to wildland fires to a catastrophic earthquake and tsunami. A short question and answer session will follow each presentation, and a longer dialogue will take place at the end. The goal is partly to make citizens aware of the city and county's plans and resources to confront disasters, but the forum will also drive home an unpleasant truth. In the first few days post-Cascadia, survivors may be on their own. Bridges will fail, buildings will fall, large swaths of earth will liquefy and produce landslides, and city roads and streets will be impassable. Police Chief Brad Johnston advises citizens to prepare themselves such that they could survive without first responders and even help their neighbors. The forum will be held from 6 to 8:30 p.m. Doors open at 5:30 p.m. Eric Bengel of the Daily Astorian for Coast Community Radio.
Marijuana cultivation is estimated to use 1% of America's electricity output. That's enough juice to power 1.7 million average homes. As more states make the drug legal in some form, that power consumption is expected to soar. Northwest Energy officials project cannabis grows will suck up 3% of the region's power by 2035. Leah Moriarty reports on efforts underway to get growers to reduce their energy use.
John Kaguya cuts right to the chase.
Indoor cannabis cultivation is extraordinarily energy intensive.
Kaguya is director of industry analytics for New Frontier, a Washington, D.C.-based cannabis industry consulting firm. For example, he says,
for every kilo of marijuana produced, the energy footprint equates to 4.3 tons of carbon dioxide and the equivalent of 7 cross-country trips in a car that is getting 44 miles per gallon.
Kaguya recently authored a study that details the growing power consumption of cannabis grows and lays out the risks it poses, not only to the power grid and the environment, but to marijuana businesses themselves. Faced with a burgeoning legal marketplace, growers are facing vigorous competition, leading to tighter profit margins.
As the price of cannabis falls, energy use becomes a growing part of their operational cost, and growers who are focused on energy efficiency are increasingly gaining a competitive advantage.
Colt Hansen owns Grow City, a store in Medford that sells indoor growing equipment. He says the metal halide and high-pressure sodium lights that have long been the favorites of indoor cannabis growers are starting to yield to fluorescence and other energy-efficient technologies.
In our store, we've seen a large increase in T5 lighting fixtures from what I'm used to, and the LEDs we've been bringing in are selling out as fast as I can bring them in.
Even so, Hansen says many longtime growers tend to be set in their ways and are reluctant to change what's been a winning formula.
It's like your grandma's got that recipe for that perfect batch of cookies. You don't go changing their recipe at all. And so most of these people have learned this rule of thumb for themselves, and veering away from that is just unheard of.
As a grower himself, Hansen says it's more than just habit that makes many growers reluctant to embrace new lighting technologies.
You got to understand that these experiments cost these guys thousands of dollars in power and air conditioning and food and nutrients. And so if it goes bad, it's affecting either a patient's medicine or, their business.
Adam Bartini with the Energy Trust of Oregon gets that concern.
We can know with fairly good certainty whether a particular lighting fixture is going to save energy. I guess the question is how well it's going to grow cannabis and how happy that particular grower is going to be with the product.
The Energy Trust has been working for years with homeowners, businesses, and industries to help them cut their energy use. And Bartini says the rapidly expanding cannabis industry is showing interest in the trust's services.
We've completed or have in our project pipeline about 23 projects at this point. Interest is definitely picking up.
The Energy Trust offers free technical assistance to identify ways to reduce power use.
We can have an energy efficiency engineer go out to the site. They scope out the different opportunities, and we can produce a technical study for that customer.
The trust can also offer cash incentives that can cover up to half the upfront capital cost of installing efficient lighting and other energy-saving equipment. The New Frontier study says using more efficient lights is an improvement, but growing cannabis in greenhouses or outdoors using free sunlight is even better, reducing electricity costs by up to 90%. Peter Gross, with the Green Valley Wellness Dispensary and Talent, says he's grown both indoors and outdoors, and while each has its pros and cons, given the ideal growing climate in Southern Oregon and Northern California, outdoors makes a lot of sense.
You just get like much bigger plants with much less energy consumption.
Among the recommendations offered by the New Frontier Report are more research on new energy-efficient lighting technologies, as well as changing rules in some jurisdictions that discourage or even ban outdoor grows. If the cannabis industry is to thrive, it concludes, growers will have to make energy conservation a top priority. I'm Liam Moriarty reporting.
Northwest News correspondent Tom Bonsi has our final story this morning. An inventory by Public Radio of Northwest Geography found more than 200 places with names some people might consider ethnically or racially offensive. For instance, there's Negro Bend Mountain, Southwest Oregon, Chinaman's Hat in Western Idaho, in Adams County, Jew Valley in Southern Oregon, or Redmond Creek in North Central Washington. A geographic names board in Oregon has been systematically working on squaw name changes for years. Now Washington State is scrubbing place names, but Tom Bonsi learned some residents don't think it's right to erase a part of history.
By far, the most common potentially insensitive place name we found is squaw.
It's a generally offensive name for Native people. To me, it's just not a... It's not an appropriate name.
Mike Isle is a Cowlitz Tribal Councilman and member of the Washington State Committee on Geographic Names.
It doesn't have to be that everyone's offended, but if it is known to be offensive to some, that should be a reason enough to change it.
Oregon tribes and government agencies have been laboring for well over a decade to change the names of the many squaw creeks, flats, buttes, meadows, and springs in Oregon. Now Washington State is getting proactive Washington State Senator Pramila Jayapal convinced the State Department of Natural Resources to inventory objectionable place names. The agency found 36 names, and the senator's office published the list. It includes Jim Crow Point, Jim Crow Creek, and Jim Crow Hill in Wakayakum County along the Lower Columbia River. At first, the locals did not appreciate politicos from Seattle and Olympia telling them what's best, according to Joe Budnick of Kathlamet, the county seat.
The inference that we were racist and that we were stupid and didn't know that we were offending people and all this other stuff, when we're not.
By Budnick's telling, Jim Crow Point and Creek were named after an Indian chief. Another source says the name comes from crows that nested in trees on the riverbank. Yet others suspect the name was a demeaning reference to a 19th century African-American Navy deserter who settled in the area. Whatever the true origin, Budnick took the initiative to suggest replacement names, which quickly found support at a Geographic Names Committee meeting where I met him.
I just wanted to get it over with because the papers have just been telling us how stupid we are and how we need to be educated.
Another targeted name is Squaw Bay in Washington's San Juan Islands. A number of islanders have spoken up or written letters in favor of a name change for the small cove. Others want to keep the name the way it is. A consistent thread through the preservationist comments is don't succumb to political correctness and don't wipe away our history. John Shannon lives on Shaw Island.
I would never call someone a squaw. But there's a difference between making it personal and the history that goes along with the place names that have been assigned, you know, historically. And I guess I just don't see anything wrong with that.
In Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, the gatekeepers for geographic name changes are volunteer committees that meet about twice a year. Kyle Blum of the Washington Department of Natural Resources says usually those boards only consider changes when they're brought forward by the public.
Our traditional model has been to wait and respond to proposals when we get them. Our goal in working with Senator Jayapal on the initiative has been to actually go out and inform people, did you know this name exists in your area? Did you know there's a process by which it can change?
Blum's agency is trying to line up public meetings in communities to move the cumbersome name change process along. The first one is planned in King County, home to a Coon Creek. In that case and others, it's unclear if the name was given as a racial slur or if it's a reference to raccoons. A Coon Creek or bay named after the animal might just keep its name. I'm Tom Bonsi in Olympia.
That's all we have time for in this edition of The Bridge. If you missed any part or just want to hear it again, it will be available as a podcast on our website at coastradio.org. We appreciate your comments and questions. Email us at news1, that's N-E-W-S and the numeral 1 at KMUN.org. And you can like us on Facebook. I'm Kate Brister. Thank you for listening. Join us next time on The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.